chapter 15, and I invite you to turn there for the beginning point of our lesson this evening. I want to begin by telling you about my family. My mother's family lives in Pensacola. My grandmother and grandfather had 7 children, 2 sons and 5 daughters, and they had an abundance of grandchildren. Ours was the only part of the family that lived away from the rest of the family for the longest period of time. We lived in Tampa, some 500 miles away, and so the only time we'd ever get to see the rest of the family was when we would go up for some special occasion. My grandparents' house was fairly small. It seemed larger when we were younger, but having gone back to it since growing up, of course I've gotten a little bigger too, so it might be that the doorways really were big then and need to be so now for me. It seemed like it was a pretty large house, but all of the grandchildren were always ushered out on the porch while everybody ate. So we would sit around on the porch and talk. Wasn't a whole lot of other things to do in that part of Pensacola. Wasn't much of a yard to play in. And so we'd talk. And invariably, the conversation would come around to this. All of my cousins who lived in the Pensacola area would start talking about how lucky my sister and I were to not be in the Pensacola area. That it was great for us because we would only come every once in a while to Pensacola, and we would be treated royally because we were the part of the family that wasn't there all the time. My grandmother would ask what we wanted to eat, and she would fix the things that we wanted. And it seemed like they always did special things for us. And my cousins had run off this litany of benefits that my sister and I had for living away from Pensacola. And then we would turn around and talk about how great it was for them living there. That in fact they had the run of my grandmother's house, that there were places where we never ventured to go, but they just walked in and out at will, and they knew where things were in the house, and my grandmother knew things about them she didn't know about us, and she'd have to ask those things about the Walker part of her family, whereas all the other part of the family, she knew those things because she saw them on a regular basis. They ate together regularly. It was no big deal, but they had an intimacy with my grandmother and grandfather that my sister and I never had. Funny how you can be looking at the exact same thing and see exact opposite views on that. I remember when I was in high school, a good friend of mine bought a really old car. I don't know how old it was, but it was ancient. I mean, it might have been 2 years older than baseball, for all I know. And we used to love to ride around in that car. I mean, he would grind the gears, and you didn't have to worry about that because it was old anyway. And it had a huge back seat in it. I mean, the back seat was large enough that you had to get up out of it and walk forward to talk to the people in the front. Great car. We used to love it. And I always thought that was so much fun. We had such good times in that old car of his that after I got married and shortly before our second child was born, I got this notion that I was going to buy a used car, and I wanted to buy an old car like my friend had had. So I started looking at all those auto traders and all those kinds of newspapers, and I finally found an old car. It seemed to be similar to the one that my friend had had. I went out to the lot, and I looked at it, walked all around it, and opened up the door, and it was one of those doors, you know, it popped as it opened, you know, as it came open. And I sat down in it. It smelled real old and musty, like my friend's car had smelled. The steering wheel was cracked, but that was okay. It looked kind of like my friend's car. Look, there were good memories in that car. And then I started looking around. There was no radio in this car, much less a cassette player in this car. None of that. There was no air conditioner in this car. It had none of the conveniences that cars I had been driving had. There was a crank missing on one window that we thought was a lot of fun on his car, but now it's not so much fun to roll it down with a coat hanger. You see, I had a totally different view of the car. Never bought it. Didn't touch it. Walked away from it. I lost all that desire for an old car like that because my thinking had changed on that. I was looking at it from a different standpoint. Same vehicle that was so much fun when I was younger suddenly became a real pain to drive when I became older. Now, those two illustrations, I think, will serve as an introduction for our lesson tonight, because what I want to talk to you about is the attitudes we sometimes have for those who come out of the world into Christ. And it doesn't matter whether you were raised in the church, and we use that expression a lot, raised in the church. What'd you eat? Songbooks and bulletins, things like that. Yeah, we lived there all the time, played on the pews. But if you were reared in a Christian family and in a Christian environment, or a religious family and environment, or whether you became a Christian a number of years ago, but now you're relating to people who've just come into Christ or have just come to follow Jesus, we can develop one of two different attitudes toward those people. I've entitled the lesson tonight, Two Attitudes Toward the Prodigal. Because I found as I was studying the reaction of the older brother to the younger brother that some of the things that he felt toward his younger brother were things I felt toward other Christians. We dealt with a little bit of that last night if you were with us. So I'm in Luke chapter 15 and I'll recount the story for you up to the point where we'll begin reading. There are two brothers, the younger of which desires the portion of the estate that falls to him to be given to him before his father's death. And then he takes it and he goes out in the world and he squanders it. That's what makes him a prodigal, wasteful son. When he has nothing left, he decides he wants to come home. He realizes he had it good in his father's house and he wants nothing more than to be back with his family. So he decides to come home. And as he's coming down the drive toward his house, his father runs to meet him and embraces him and tells the servants to bring out a robe and bring out a ring and bring out some sandals and put them on his feet. And you just go kill a fattened calf because we're going to eat it. My son was dead and is now alive. He was lost and now is found, and let's make merry. And that's what they intend to do. And that is what they begin to do. And now you pick up with the story in verse 25, where we are this evening. Now his older son was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing, and he summoned one of the servants, and he began inquiring what these things might be. And he said to him, "Well, your brother's come, and your father's killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound." Now he could have reacted in one of two ways here. It could have said, "And he became merry." Or it says, as it reads, "But he became angry. He was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began entreating him, but he answered and said to his father, 'Look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you've never given me a kid that I might be merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who's devoured your wealth with harlots, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'My child, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to be merry and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, and he was lost and has been found.'" See the two attitudes even there between the father and the son? Almost sounds like our conversations on the porch at my grandparents' house. You know, we have to be rejoicing, my grandmother might say. We have to rejoice when the walkers come. They live so far away, they're dead to us until they come here. And then they're alive to us and we make merry. And on the other hand, "You've been with me always," she might say to my cousins who live there. What kind of attitudes do we display toward those who come to Christ? Maybe those who've lived filthy, horribly decadent lives. How do we react to them? And I suggest that we react sometimes in one of two extremes. And I'll tell you that I've been at both extremes. So if nobody else here will own up to it, I will. I've been at both of these extremes in reacting to people who come to Christ. The first of those I'll just sum up in the statement, they're not as good as we are. I mean, they're not as good as we are. If you'll go back to Mark chapter 9, please. I'm going to begin reading in verse 30. Let's begin at verse 33. Begin at verse 33, because this really sets us up for the incident that I want to key on tonight. "And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, 'What were you discussing on the way?' But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. And sitting down, he called the 12, and he said to him, 'If anyone wants to be first, he'll be last of all and servant of all.' And he took a child and stood him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever receives one child like this in my name is receiving me, and whoever receives me is not receiving me, but him who sent me.'" Now, let me set this up because this is really important. The disciples, on more than one occasion, as a matter of fact, I can recall at least four occasions where the disciples argued about who was greatest. Who is best? Who did the Lord love the most? And frankly, I've often wondered why they even argued that, because I think it was a clear-cut case that there were three of them that were Jesus' favorites. I mean, they were always in with him on things that nobody else was in on. You always have Peter, James, and John going off while the rest of them are left behind. In the Garden of Gethsemane, that's true. The Mount of Transfiguration, that's true. The raising of Jairus' daughter, that's true. At the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, that's true. There are only three of them in there. And I don't know why the argument didn't die, but for some reason it never did. Maybe it was something like, well, you know, he let me sit next to him at lunch today. I was his favorite. Or maybe somebody says, well, you know, people tell me I look more like him than the rest of you do. Or somebody says, when they see me, they always talk about how much I remind them of Jesus. I don't know on what basis they argued that they were the greatest, but that seemed to consume them. Who's really best? And then you come right on the heels of that, and I think there's a reason why, we come to verse 38. John said to him, in the same context, Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to hinder him because he was not following us. John kind of turns it. Well, even if we can't decide who's the greatest among our little group of 12, we know that we're better than the other people out there. Lord, you know, we saw somebody today who was trying to cast out demons, and he wasn't with us. And we told him to come follow us, and he wouldn't do that. So we told him to quit casting out demons in your name. He had no right to do that unless he was one of us. And he wasn't one of us. And then Jesus said, Do not hinder him, for there's no one who shall perform a miracle in my name and be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. For he who is not against us is for us. Now, I don't know what their argument was. Lord, we saw a guy and he had not been to apostle school like we've been to. I mean, he's not been a disciple as long as we have. He didn't have his password. He didn't have his card, disciple card. He wasn't one of us. He wasn't a typical disciple of yours. He hadn't gone through the things we'd gone through. He's not been with us from the beginning. He has no right to assume that he is on an equal with the rest of us. Sometimes we reach, I think, decisions like that regarding those who come to Christ late. We use similar reasoning. Why is everybody making such a big deal out of this person? Why didn't they obey the gospel a long time ago? They could have been serving the Lord all these years. But no, they go out there on the fields and they have their time and they enjoy life out there in the world, and then they decide to bring their broken, decrepit lives to Christ, and everybody makes a big deal about them. Whereas I've been sacrificing all these years. I've been doing what the Lord wanted me to do, and where are all the accolades for me? In Matthew chapter 20, Jesus tells a parable that deals with the same kind of mentality, this concern for what others are doing, how little or how much others are doing, and what kind of credit they get for that. It's found in the first 16 verses. It's the parable of the workers who are hired at different hours of the day, and they're all hired for the same amount of money. Now, if you have any trouble at all relating to this parable and the problems that ensue because of this, all you need to do to understand this parable is to take three children in a household, siblings, and say to the one, I will give you a dollar if you'll mow the yard and rake up all the dead grass. And then in the hearing of that one, say to the second one, I'll give you a dollar if you'll just wash up the dishes, which will take about 30 minutes. And then say to the third child, I'll give you a dollar if you'll just smile at me and give me a kiss on the cheek. And you watch what those siblings will do to one another. The first words out of their mouths will be, that's not fair. That's not fair. My daughters use that. They have used that for years. That's their favorite expression to use. That's not fair. Greatest line. Some of you know him. Tim Beaver, years ago, gave me the greatest line to respond to that. And so I started using it immediately. My daughters would say, Dad, that's not fair. I'd say, life's not fair. If it was, I wouldn't have had you. Then I smile at him. The parable of the workers in the vineyard illustrates this very point for us. And the point that Jesus makes, the master at the end, is, I have made a contract with you. I've made an agreement, and you've agreed to the results of that agreement. You've agreed for the payment that I offered you. And whatever I give anybody else is between me and them, not between you and me and them. If it's fair wages for you, and if you told that first child, let's go back to the illustration, is a dollar worth it to mow the lawn and rake the lawn? If that child says yes, if they do, then that agreement stands between you and that child. And if the other child agrees to kiss you on the cheek and smile for you for a dollar, and that's the agreement you have with that child, that agreement stands independent of the earlier one. And the point Jesus is making is for you and me, because sometimes Ralph Walker gets to be a big whiner. I whine about my relationship in the kingdom of God, because I have to go to things that other Christians don't have to go to. Somebody comes to me with a big problem. They've got a great problem, and the burden now becomes mine, and I help them carry it, and I turn to my wife and say, you know, nobody else at church is having to deal with this. I'm the only one having to deal with this problem. Why do I always get these problems? Why can't somebody else deal with those things? And sometimes in our relationship with new Christians, we who've been Christians a long time, develop that same mentality. We're carrying the load. We're bearing the burdens. We're providing all the nourishment. And these new Christians, like babes, come in and just take, take, and take again. And the point is, did I agree with the Lord to give myself to Him, lock, stock, and barrel, everything I am and everything I have and everything I will be? Did I agree to give that to Him in exchange for eternal life? And the answer is yes. And if that's the case, then I really don't have anything to beef about. That's what Matthew chapter 20 is telling us. In Matthew chapter 18, in verses 21 through 35, there's another parable told. It's a parable of the servant who was forgiven and didn't forgive. And I think that's an important parable and has an impact on what we're talking about tonight also. I mean, if we were to ask the question, apart from the individual that's under consideration, some person who truly has lived a despicable life, maybe even done things against us, maybe it's a member of our family or a friend of ours who's wronged us in some deep, wounding way, maybe taken something from us and sold it or gotten rid of it or destroyed it, and now comes to the Lord and says, I've lived a bad life, I want to be forgiven, and I want to come back to the Lord, and we're sitting over there with our arms crossed saying, huh. You know, you think it's that easy. And you think you can just walk in here among God's people and you can ask for baptism for the remission of your sins and then everything's forgotten and forgiven? And as we think that, I picture the Lord on the other side of us with His arms crossed saying to me, huh, and you thought it was that easy. Well, see, it was for me. God did forgive me that way. He forgave everything I had done that was wrong, and He didn't require me to go back through that long list of things I'd done and make recompense before I could receive forgiveness. He didn't do that with me. And I have no right to do that to another. And the servant who was forgiven and then went out and pounded on his fellow servant who owed him some money displayed the very attitude that you and I need to avoid. If we are forgiven, we must forgive. And if God forgave us much, then we must in turn forgive much. You see, the older son just isn't willing to do that. You know, last night, you remember we talked about the terminology that he uses in Luke chapter 15. As he's talking to his father, he never refers to him as my brother. Never even calls him by name. He says, your son. And the father, when he replies to him, brings him back to reality by saying, no, no, this brother of yours, in verse 32. He's reminding him of his relationship with him. One of the things that's important to remember when someone comes to the Lord is that we've been there. Maybe not with the same sins. Maybe I was never addicted to drugs, but I may have been addicted to materialism. I may have never committed fornication. I may have never been a sexual prostitute. But I might have been a financial prostitute. And I may have committed fornication in my heart. And those same things that condemn them condemn you and condemn me. And sometimes it may appear that their sins are more heinous or more obvious. But as we said last night, that doesn't mean that our sins won't keep us from heaven. Let me give you an illustration. It's hard for us to maybe see things the way people of the world see things. And sometimes we're very quick to judge a person's intents or their heart without really giving them credit first for their actions. I don't know whether this story is apocryphal or not. I've heard it told by a particular preacher, and he'll remain nameless, and he's not here. And now don't all look over at David and see if, you know, he indicates that it was him. But I heard a story about a gospel preacher who was preaching, and a woman in the audience who had been and heard one or two sermons before responded to the invitation to follow Jesus. And she came to the front and she expressed her desire to be baptized. This was an older building, and some buildings you've been in, those of you who've been in Christians a long time, know that some buildings have a baptistry that's out in the front. It's in the floor. It's like a trap door type door that comes open right in the floor, and there's a baptismal pool right out in the floor in front of everybody rather than up high and raised. This building had such a baptismal pool. And so after the preacher had talked to the woman and she had expressed her desire to be baptized, he sent her off into a room with a couple of the ladies so that she could change into the baptismal garments and come out. Meanwhile, he went back and got into this waiter's, and he walked out and he stepped down into the pool, and he was sitting there waiting for her to come out. Well, when she had gone back into the room, as the story goes, she had told the ladies that she knew she was going to be baptized that morning, and she had brought appropriate clothing. So they stepped out of the room while she got dressed. And she came walking out of the room and across the front of the auditorium to eyes that looked like deer caught in headlamps because she was in a string bikini. Now, how would you judge that woman? You know, some of us would say, how despicable. I mean, that she would be in a church building in a bikini. And what does she think she's doing? Well, I'll tell you what she thought she was doing. She dressed appropriately to go in the water. That's what she had been used to dressing in. She was of the world. She never thought in the terms that you and I might think in about that situation. It seemed perfectly logical to her. She's going in the water. She would wear what she wears in the water. Might not be what you and I would wear in the water. I'd hope not. But that's what she thought was appropriate. Now, how do you judge such a person? How do you judge someone who walks into our assembly in a tank top? A tank top. With one long earring hanging out of his ear, and this years before it was fashionable for men to wear earrings. In a tank top with hair halfway down his back. Would you sit next to him? Would you welcome him? Or would you sit way off at the other end of the pew and keep looking at him and wondering, what is he doing here? I'll tell you what he was doing there. He's a friend of mine now because he became a Christian that day. And he's a preacher of the gospel today. How do you judge people like that? The prodigals that come to the Lord. Are they as good as we are? Well, I'll tell you what. Christ died for them. And if that doesn't put a value on their heads, more precious than anything you or I could judge them by, I don't know what price you could pay. We who have been Christians a long time need to make sure, too, of one other thing, and then we'll move on to our next point. And that is, sometimes we say, you know, I've been a Christian 20 years. Well, what does that mean? That means I've had 20 years experience. Well, maybe not. We might have just had 1 year's experience 20 times over. There is a difference. I mean, are you a 20 times a Christian you were the first year you became a child of God? If so, then you might have something of which to boast. But if all you've done is repeat what you repeated the very first year you became a Christian, you're no more righteous, you're no more holy, you're no more knowledgeable of the Word, you're no more valuable in the kingdom of God than the first year you became a Christian, it really doesn't seem to me that we have much much to say to those who've just become Christians. Now, I've been there, and I've repented of that attitude. And I'll tell you where else I've been. I've been on the other extreme, and that is this. You know these prodigals that come to the Lord out of the world? I mean, they have a salvation experience that the rest of us who were raised in righteous families just can't understand. We just can't know it. I mean, there have been times, I will tell you, there have been times when I said, you know, I kind of wished I had done all those things, because when those people come to the Lord, they just seem so full of the grace of God and His mercy that it seems so different than my own conversion experience. And sometimes we long for that. Anybody else been there? I've seen a couple of you nod your heads. Anybody else been there? You thought that? You know, I mean, it would almost be better to have known how bad sin is. I mean, to really get down and dirty in it and then come out of it, because we'd appreciate it so much more. You know, that's the exact same argumentation that's found in Romans chapter 3. In Romans chapter 1, God indicts the Gentiles for their sinfulness. And the Jews who are reading Romans probably said, boy, that is right. They are pretty bad people. Then in chapter 2, the apostle comes back and he indicts the Jews. He says, but you know, really, you are no better than they were. And in chapter 3, Romans chapter 3, they ask this question. Verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew? I mean, we don't have any advantage over them at all. We're just as much sinners as they are. What advantage do we have in being Jews? What is the benefit of circumcision? Is there any? I mean, that's a question we need to ask. Is there a benefit in having followed Christ all your life? Let's consider the case. Let's consider the argument. Number one, we don't know what it's like to really struggle with sin and overcome it. So we don't fully appreciate the grace God has extended to us. In other words, if you never knew you were drowning, you don't appreciate a lifesaver. And it's those people who are out in the world, I mean, who knew they were lost, I mean, had a real sincere and deep fear that they were going to hell because of the actions in their lives, that's the person who really appreciates the grace of God. Point number two. We can't really judge, effectively, the relative values of righteousness and sinfulness like those people who've really tasted it. But if we had known the hopelessness of sin, then maybe we wouldn't be as tempted to fall back into it. You understand that argument? See, the point is, I mean, they've been out there, they've tasted it, they know that it's hopeless. They know there's no real joy out there. I got to tell you, you know, I can say, well, I know that drugs are bad for you. I know they're bad for you because I've heard about that. I've read about it. And I've talked to people who are involved in it. But I can't say from a firsthand experience, let me tell you, you don't want to get involved in drugs. It's a dead-end street. I can't say that firsthand because I never experienced that. And I sometimes think the person who would be most effective in talking about drug addiction would be somebody who's been there, who can say, you want me to tell you what it's like? I'll tell you what it's like. I've been there, and it's a dead-end street. And they're not as tempted to get back into that kind of thing once they've escaped it and come away from it, known how hopeless it is, as a person who's never known what it was like. You know, if you haven't tried it, you can't say much about it, seems to be the argument there. Third, we know the sameness of Christianity, but not the newness it has. I mean, we know what it's like to be a Christian. I've heard a cappella singing all my life. All my life, ever since I was a little boy, I've heard and participated in a cappella singing. And while there are times, occasionally, when it moves me, sometimes to tears, sometimes to exuberance and joy, it doesn't affect me, I'm sure, the way it does somebody who walks in an auditorium. Can't you imagine? I mean, some of you have been there, so you know what I'm talking about. But for the rest of us, can you just imagine what that's like? I mean, you walk into a typical assembly, and you're used to the typical kinds of worship services that so many of the religious groups put on. And you're used to hearing a few people singing, perhaps, in an audience being drowned out by some kind of organ or piano or a huge choir that overpowers the rest of the congregation, trained voices. And you walk into this group, and the first thing you notice is there's no place for a choir, and there's not the normal situation set up for an instrument of music, and you're looking around, you're wondering, boy, I wonder what kind of singing is going to take place here. And then you hear all these voices break out into this, not trained voices in the sense of people who have become skilled at this because that's their occupation, but people who have become skilled in it because that's what they want to give to the Lord. And they sing, and I've watched people do that. I love to see people who've never been in one of our assemblies, and they kind of look around, you know, at first, and they're glancing around, and they get these smiles on their faces. They've never heard anything like this before, and it's wonderful. Don't you wish sometimes you could experience that? And I've heard it all my life. I've known the sameness of Christianity, but I've never known the newness of it in the way that a person who's never known Christ knows it. I mean, compare your conversion to the Apostle Paul's. You know, here's the Apostle Paul who's been involved in Judaism all his life. He's steeped in that. He's a student of Gamaliel. He is surpassing all his brethren. And then he has this wonderful conversion experience as he meets the Lord on the road to Damascus. I mean, what a shocking experience that must have been for him. And that 3 days spent in prayer and fasting as he's trying to relate to this new God he's found. I mean, what an experience. And I'm sure Paul could have gone around talking about that, you know, at great length. And he did on a couple of occasions talk about his experience. What can I say? I can say, well, you know, I was about 13 years old, and my parents had trained me all along that they wanted me to become a Christian. I knew that's what I should do. I became aware that I was a sinner and that I hadn't done any terrible things, not in the eyes of the world, but I knew I'd done some wrong things. And one morning, I became a Christian. And probably a lot of people would want to go, and? You know, I mean, is there more to that? I mean, don't you have an experience like Paul had? No, I didn't. I didn't. And for a lot of us, we didn't. And we might say, well, you know, maybe it would be better to know the newness of Christianity, not the sameness of Christianity. And finally, one last point, a fourth one, is that the old idea that a bone once broken is twice as strong, that if you've never had doubts about your Christianity, I mean, if you've never really doubted God, your faith isn't as strong as one who has doubted. As one who has questioned and wondered, is there really a God? And is Jesus really his son? And people who've wrestled with that and gone out there in the world and experienced that kind of a cynicism and that kind of critical thinking about God have a greater faith than those of us who were raised in a Christian home. Well, I don't know if any of those four points are points you've ever thought about before, but I dare say that some of you have reasoned along those lines before. Am I correct? Some of you have. Well, what is the response to that? I mean, is it better to have been out there in the world? What advantage do we have as spiritual Jews and as those who've been spiritually circumcised? Well, first of all, you need to understand that this elder brother who had been with his father all along, and we talked about him and the fact that he didn't appreciate his father's household, remember? I mean, he had everything. His father says, everything I've had is yours. You don't appreciate it, though, like the prodigal does, because the prodigal's been out there in the field. Yeah, but there's another point, another aspect of that to be considered. The prodigal has wasted months, maybe years of his life in sin. Wasted it. Wasted it. It's of no value to him or anybody else. Whereas those of us who are disciples of Jesus, we've been spending those same years in training, in learning more about God and more about His Son Jesus, in learning how to be more effective servants of His. Certainly that apprenticeship counts for something. Secondly, the prodigal hasn't lived with the Word. I mean, he's not intimate with Him. He's not intimate with Him, the Word, Jesus Christ, nor with the written Word. Watch those same people when they come to Christ. And the preachers, you know, sometimes we preachers are not real kind to those people. We say, and turn over here in Matthew chapter 4, verse 12, and everybody else is turning to Matthew chapter 4, verse 12 very quickly. And meanwhile, what are they doing? They're running back to that beginning table of contents, Matthew, Matthew, Matthew. What in the world does that look like? There it is, Matthew, page 250, and they get over there to that page and they look, and about the time they get there and say, there, the preacher says, and over here in Zechariah, oh goodness, back to the beginning again, and they run that down, and they don't know the Word. And passages that we quote and that we remember and that we treasure in our hearts because we've heard those all our lives and they mean something to us, it's all so new to the new convert. You know, one of the points that's made there in Romans chapter 3, the answer In fact, the only answer that's given in that chapter, what advantage does the Jew have? The answer given by Paul in verse 2 is, it's great in every respect. First of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God. Entrusted with the oracles of God. You've got the word of the Lord living in you in a way and for a length of time that the new convert simply doesn't have. I mean, think about all the advantages you have if you've been a Christian for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years over the person who's just come to Christ. Yes, they have some things that maybe you don't have now. But would you trade that? I mean, would you really trade that for knowing some of the songs you know by heart? How many of the songs that Joel led us in tonight do you know by heart? You didn't even have to open a book if you didn't want to. And those songs are yours day or night because you've heard them over and over again. Passages that are yours because they're familiar passages. Bible characters that are discussed. Somebody says, Joseph, you immediately know who Joseph is. Even when they say, Joseph of Arimathea, you know who that person is because you know those stories, you've heard those truths. They've become second nature to you. They're part of what you are. Would you trade all of that and become a new Christian again? Never forget that many times these prodigals carry with them scars that are never erased. The young man that I told you about a few moments ago that entered the worship service in such worldly array, who became a Christian and later a preacher, he says, I still can't talk about some of the things in my life. I still can't talk about some of the things I did. They're so embarrassing and so shameful to me. I can't believe now, knowing Christ and knowing what righteousness and holiness are, I cannot believe that I did and said some of the things I did and said. I never can forget those. They will scar me all my life. The older son did never have anything that he needed to be ashamed of as far as his actions were concerned, save this reaction to his brother. Would you trade that to be a prodigal? I mean, would you trade that sense of well-being that you have if you were raised by godly parents and your life was relatively good and pure? Would you trade that to be a prodigal for the newness of salvation? Sometimes prodigals carry with them the baggage of divorce, a loss of reputation, tremendous financial debt, physical loss, loss of health. Would you trade for those things your security in Christ? Final point, and then we're through. Prodigals lose time saving others. I know a man who was 55 years old before he became a Christian. 55 years old. His wife had been a Christian for years. I had known her. She was a member of the congregation of which I was a part and I grew up in. And I was back for a meeting when this man obeyed the gospel. 55 years old. And as we talked after services that night about his conversion and how wonderful he felt, he said, well, you know, I do feel good, but I have a terrible regret and a great sense of loss that I feel tonight. I asked him why, and he said, because I wasn't a Christian to tell my parents before they died they needed Jesus Christ. Wow, think about that. I mean, if you become a Christian perhaps late in your life, or maybe you've missed the opportunity to tell some of your closest friends about Jesus because you lived in the fields of sin with them, the loss that must be yours. So what I'm really saying to you tonight is I think that both the reactions that we've talked about are erroneous reactions. Both of them are overreactions. I don't think that we ought to treat those who haven't been Christian very long as if they're some kind of second-class Christian, some kind of person that's a pariah or maybe just a little better than that. Nor should we, on the other hand, act like they've got everything we don't have. Look at all the benefits and advantages they have. You know, the point is, we've all made a contractual agreement with the Lord to follow Him. Wherever we are in our lives, we make that agreement. The agreement now is for life. And the real point for us is, the sooner you come to follow the Lord, the better off you'll be, the better off the kingdom will be, and the better off those around you will be. That's the really important point. So if you've been thinking about putting it off,
Well, some of the things that guy said tonight make sense. I think I'll just stay in the world a little while longer, and then I'll really appreciate it when I become a Christian. You may not live that long. You may die long. That'd be a great training, wouldn't it? I don't want that to happen to you. So I'm inviting you to follow Jesus tonight. Now would be a really good time for you to come home. And now would be a really good time for you to follow Jesus and to give him your life wherever you are, whatever you've done. He accepts you, and the people of God here accept you as one of their own. There is no sin that you have committed that cannot be repented of and forgiven. Would you like to be forgiven by him? Would you like to come home like the Father? Would you like to be in your Father's house from now until death and then live with him forever? The promise is waiting. All you have to do is accept the promise. Come, give yourself to me. Tonight. Right now. Come to the front now.